Said guest, module 2, sustainable environment. There are three chapters. The first is the end of living and the beginning of survival by Chief Settle. The second is on killing a tree by Jeev Patel. The third is Slatty the God by Isaac Bashevis Singer. The first is the end of living and the beginning of survival by Chief Settle. Introduction. Chief Settle, 1786 to 1866, was born on the Black River near Blake Island in what is now the city of Kent, Washington. His father was a leader of the Suquamish, a Native American tribe, and his mother belonged to Duwamish tribe. Chief Settle was a prominent figure among his people with remarkable leadership skills. He earned reputation at a young age as a leader of the Native Americans and a warrior, often defeating groups of tribal enemy raiders. He was tall and broad, standing nearly 6 feet tall, and it is said that when he addressed an audience, his voice could be heard at a distance of 1.2 kilometers. He was a noted orator in his native language. He had the ability to understand the white settlers' real intention for land grab, but pursued a path of accommodation with them. He was baptized Noah into the Roman Catholic Church by French missionaries in 1848. He formed a personal relationship with Doc Maynard, an adventurous entrepreneur, who negotiated relatively peaceful relations between the settlers and the tribes. Chief Settle died on 7 June 1866 on the Suquamish Reservation at Port Madison, Washington. The city of Settle in the U.S. state of Washington is named after him. The Suquamish tribe honors Chief Settle in the third week of August every year as Chief Settle Days. Chief Settle delivered the speech presently entitled as The End of Living and the Beginning of Survival on March 11, 1854, date disputed, at a large outdoor gathering in Settle. The meeting with Chief Settle had been called by Governor Isaac Ingall Stevens to discuss surrender or sale of native land to white settlers. Chief Settle spoke in the Lushootse language, and there existed various versions of the speech due to differences in translation. However, the authenticity of the speech is doubted, as different versions of the same speech are in circulation. The translation of the speech is flowery Victorian English, published in Settle's Sunday Star by Henry Hay. Smith, a poet, doctor, and early white settler of the Settle area, on 29 October 1887, is a combination of history and imagination. A second version, which appeared in the 1960s, was due to the efforts of William Arrowsmith, who was interested in cleansing the passage of its Victorian and Greek overtones. The extract used in the textbook is based on Ted Perry's script made for the promotion of the environmental movie Home, which was produced in the U.S. by the Southern Baptist Convention in 1972. Presently, scholars agree that all the versions of the speech are equally inauthentic. The End of Living and the Beginning of Survival has been widely cited as a powerful, bittersweet plea for respect of Native American rights and environmental values. The speech achieved widespread fame due to its promotion in the environmental movement, as it lays stress on the interdependence and interconnections of the world of the living and the non-living. Man, Chief Settle reminds us, did not weave the web of life. He is merely a strand in it. Non-human life, two as intrinsic values, not dependent on a scale of their utility. Chief Sittle's speech places all forms of life in a network of interdependence. The idea of buying or selling land or cruelty to animals was strange to the Native Americans. In the context of symbiosis and deep ecology, the speech assumes special significance when Chief Sittle says, "The earth does not belong to man. Man belongs to the earth. This we know. All things are connected like the blood which unites one family. All things are connected." Now, the introduction is over. We are coming to the text. The president in Washington sends word that he wishes to buy our land. How can you buy or sell the sky, the warmth of the land? The idea is strange to us. If we do not own the freshness of the air and the sparkle of the water, how can you buy them? Every part of this earth is sacred to my people. Every shining pine needle, every sandy shore, every mist in the dark woods, every clearing and humming insect is holy in the memory and experience of my people. The sap which courses through the trees carries the memories of the red man. The white man's dead forget the country of their birth when they go to walk among the stars. Our dead never forget this beautiful earth, for it is the mother of the red man. We are part of the earth, and it is part of us. The perfume flowers are our sisters, the deer, the horse, the great eagle, these are brothers. The rocky crests, the juices in the meadows, the body heat of the pony and man all belong to the same family. So, when the great chief in Washington sends word that he wishes to buy our land, he asks much of us. The great chief sends word he will reserve us a place so that we can live comfortably to ourselves. He will be a father and we will be his children. So, we will consider your offer to buy our land. But it will not be easy, for this land is sacred to us. This shining water that moves in the streams and rivers is not just water, but the blood of our ancestors. If we sell you the land, you must remember that it is sacred, and you must teach your children that it is sacred, that each ghostly reflection in the clear water of the lakes tells of events and memories in the life of my people. The waters murmur in the voice of my father's father. The rivers are our brothers. They quench our thirst. The rivers carry our canoes and feed our children. If we sell you our land, you must remember and teach your children that the rivers are our brothers and yours, and you must henceforth give the rivers the kindness you would give my brother. We know that the white man does not understand our ways. One portion of land is the same to him as the next. For he is a stranger who comes in the night and takes from the land whatever he needs. The earth is not his brother, but his enemy. And when he has conquered it, he moves on. He leaves his father's grave behind, and he does not care. He kidnaps the earth from his children, and he does not care. His father's grave and his children's birthright are forgotten. He treats his mother, the earth, and his brother, the sky, as things to be bought, plundered, sold like sheep or bright beads. His appetite will devour the earth and leave behind only a desert. I do not know. Our ways are different than yours. The sight of your cities pains the eyes of the red man. There is no quiet place in the white man's cities. No place to hear the unfurling of leaves in spring or the rustle of the insect's wings. The clatter only seems to insult the ears. And what is there to life if a man cannot hear the lonely cry of the whippoorwill or the arguments of the frogs around the pond at night? I am a red man and do not understand. The Indian prefers the soft sound of the wind darting over the face of a pond and the smell of the wind itself, cleaned by a midday rain or scented with pinyon pine. The air is precious to the red man, for all things share the same breath. The beast, the tree, the man, they all share the same breath. The white man does not seem to notice the air he breathes. Like a man dying for many days, he is numbed to the stench. But if we sell you our land, you must remember that the air is precious to us, that the air shares its spirit with all the life it supports. The wind that gave our grandfather his first breath also receives his last sigh. And if we sell you our land, you must keep it apart and sacred as a place where even the white man can go to taste the wind that is sweetened by the meadow's flowers. So, we will consider your offer to buy our land. If we decide to accept, I will make one condition. The white man must treat the beasts of this land as his brothers. I am a savage and do not understand any other way. I have seen 1,000 rotting buffaloes on the prairie, left by the white man who shot them from a passing train. I am a savage and do not understand how the smoking iron horse can be made more important than the buffalo that we kill only to stay alive. What is man without the beasts? If all the beasts were gone, man would die from a great loneliness of the spirit. For whatever happens to the beasts soon happens to man. All things are connected. You must teach your children that the ground beneath their feet is the ashes of your grandfathers, so that they will respect the land. Tell your children that the earth is rich with the lives of us kin. Teach your children that we have taught our children that the earth is our mother. Whatever befalls the earth befalls the sons of earth. If men spit upon the ground, they spit upon themselves. Thus we know the earth does not belong to man. Man belongs to the earth. This we know. All things are connected like the blood which unites one family. All things are connected. Even the white man, whose God walks and talks with him as friend to friend, cannot be exempt from the common destiny. We may be brothers after all. We shall see. One thing we know, which the white man may one day discover, a God is the same God. You may think now that you own him as you wish to own our land, but you cannot. He is the God of man, and his compassion is equal for the red man and the white. The earth is precious to him, and to harm the earth is to heap contempt on its creator. The whites too shall pass, perhaps sooner than all other tribes. Contaminate your bed, and you will one night suffocate in your own waste. But in your perishing, you will shine brightly fired by the strength of the God who brought you to this land and for some special purpose gave you dominion over this land and over the red man. That destiny is a mystery to us, for we do not understand when the buffalo are all slaughtered, the wild horses are tamed, the secret corners of the forest heavy with the scent of many men and the view of the ripe hills blotted by talking wires, Where is the thicket? Gone. Where is the eagle? Gone. The end of living and the beginning of survival. Now the text is over. Now coming to glossary. The first meaning sparkle, meaning to shine brightly with flashes of light. The next is pine needle, meaning the thin sharp leaves that grow on pine trees. Next, clearing, meaning open space. Next, sap, meaning juice. Next, courses, meaning passes through. Next, great chief in Washington, meaning Governor Isaac Ingall Stevens, the first governor of Washington Territory, serving from 1853 to 1857. Next, canoe, meaning a light, narrow boat with pointed ends and no keel, propelled with a paddle or paddles. Next, plunder, meaning to rob. Next, devour, meaning to eat greedily. Next, unfurling, meaning unfolding, opening out. Next, clatter, meaning loud noise. Next, whippoorwill, meaning nocturnal goat sucker of the eastern USA and Canada, related to European nightjar. Next, pine and pine, meaning a variety of pine groves in the southwestern United States and in Mexico. The trees yield edible pinion nuts, which were a staple of the Native Americans and are still widely eaten as a snack in New Mexican cuisine. Next, to dart over, meaning to speed along. Next, savage, meaning uncivilized. Here, the term indicates the cultural difference between the whites and the natives. The vision of the whites is a savage one. Next, prairie, meaning a large area of level or rolling land in the Mississippi Valley that in its natural uncultivated state has deep fertile soil, a cover of tall coarse grass and few trees, land in or predominantly in grass. Next, smoking iron ores, meaning a reference to trains. Next, kin, meaning kinsman relations. Next, contaminate, to defile, pollute, taint. Next, suffocate, meaning be unable to breathe. Next, dominion, meaning control over a country or people. Next, blotted, meaning marred or stained. Next, talking wires, meaning telephones. Next, thicket, meaning the dense growth of shrubbery or small trees. Now the glossary is over. Coming to exercises, the first section, answer the following questions. First question, in which year did Chief Settle make the address titled The End of Living and the Beginning of Survival? Option A, 1866. Option B, 1854. Option C, 1887. Option D, 1845. Second question, in which language did Chief Settle make his speech? Option A, French. Option B, English. Option C, Lushootseed. Option D, Spanish. Third question, whose translation of Chief Settle's speech was published in Settle Sunday Star in 1887? Fourth question, whom does Chief Settle mean by the great chief in Washington? Question 5. What does Settle mean by the smoking iron horse? Question 6. To which tribe did Chief Settle belong? The first section is over. The next is answer the following questions in a sentence or two. First question, what does Settle say that buying or selling the land is strange to Native Americans? Question number 2. What are the different attitudes of the whites and the Native Americans to the country of their birth? Question 3. What does Seattle say about the cities of the white man? Question number 4. How does the Native American see the rivers and the earth? Question 5. What does Seattle want the white man to teach their children? Question 6. What is the difference between living and surviving? Question 7. Explain the sarcasm in the words of Seattle when he says, "I'm a savage and do not understand." Question 8. What will happen to man if all the beasts are gone? Question 9. How does the Indian look upon water? Question 10. What are the conditions laid by Seattle to send his land to the great chief? The second section is over. The third section, answer the following questions in a paragraph. First question, the different approaches of the whites and the Native Americans to environment. Question 2, Native American criticism of the white man's treatment of Mother Earth. Question 3, comment on the passion and feeling conveyed in Seattle's speech. Question 4, the interdependence of the world of the living and the non-living based on Seattle's speech. Third section is over. Coming to fourth section, answer the following questions in about 300 words. Question 1. Summarize the major arguments in Chief Seattle's speech. Question 2. Chief Seattle's speech is a powerful plea for respect of Native Americans' rights and environmental values. Substantiate. Activity. Number 1. Find out literary texts from the Native American writers who discuss the symbiosis and interconnectedness of man and non-human. Question 2. Below is given the famous Henry A. Smith version of T. Settle's speech. Attempt a comparative study. Yonder sky that has wept tears of compassion upon my people for centuries untold, and which to us appears changeless and eternal, may change. Today is fair. Tomorrow it may be overcast with clouds. My words are like the stars that never change. Whatever Seattle says, the great chief in Washington can rely upon with as much certainty as he can upon the return of the sun or the seasons. The white chief says that big chief at Washington sends us greetings of friendship and goodwill. This is kind of him, for we know he has little need of our friendship in return. His people are many. They are like the grass that covers vast prairies. My people are few. They resemble the scattering trees of storm-wept plain. The great and, I presume, good white chief sends us word that he wishes to buy our land, but is willing to allow us enough to live comfortably. This indeed appears just, even generous, for the red man no longer has rights that he need respect, and the offer may be wise also, as we are no longer in need of an extensive country. There was a time when our people covered the land as the waves of a wind-ruffled sea cover its shell pale flow, but that time long since passed away with the greatness of tribes that are now but a mournful memory. I will not dwell on, nor mourn over, our untimely decay, nor reproach my pale-faced brothers with hastening it, as we too may have been somewhat to blame. Youth is impulsive. When our young men grow angry at some real or imaginary wrong, and disfigure their faces with black paint, it denotes that their hearts are black and that they are often cruel and relentless, and our old men and old women are unable to restrain them. Thus it has ever been. Thus it was when the white men began to push our forefathers ever westward. But let us hope that the hostilities between us may never return. We would have everything to lose and nothing to gain. Revenge by young men is considered gain, even at the cost of their own lives. But old men who stay at home in times of war and mothers who have sons to lose know better. Our good father in Washington, for I presume he is now our father as well as yours, since King George has moved his boundaries further north, our great and good father, I say, sends us word that if we do as he decides, he will protect us. His brave warriors will be to us a bristling wall of strength, and his wonderful ships of war will fill our harbors so that our ancient enemies far to the northward, the Harers and Tishomans, will cease to frighten our women, children, and all men. Then in reality, he will be our father and we his children. But can that ever be? Your God is not our God. Your God loves your people and hates mine. He folds his strong protecting arms lovingly about the pale face and leads him by the hand, as a father leads an infant son. But he has forsaken his red children. If they really are his, our God, the Great Spirit, seems also to have forsaken us. Your God makes your people wax stronger every day. Soon they will fill at the land. Our people are ebbing away like a rapidly receding tide that will never return. The white man's God cannot love our people or he would protect them. They seem to be orphans who can look nowhere for help. How then can we be brothers? How can your God become our God and renew our prosperity and can awaken in us dreams of returning greatness? If we have a common heavenly Father, he must be partial. For he came to his pale-faced children, we never saw him. He gave you laws, but had no word for his red children, whose teeming multitudes once filled with vast continent, as stars fill the firmament. No, we are two distinct races with separate origins and separate destinies. There is little in common between us. To us, the ashes of our ancestors are sacred and their resting place is hallowed ground. You wander far from the graves of your ancestors and seemingly without regret. Your religion was written upon tablets of stone by the iron finger of your God so that you could not forget. The red man could never comprehend or remember it. Our religion is the traditions of our ancestors, the dreams of our old men, given them in solemn hours of the night by the Great Spirit, and the visions of our sachems, and is written in the hearts of our people. Your dead cease to love you and the land of their nativity. As soon as they pass the portals of the tomb and wander away beyond the stars, they are soon forgotten and never return. Our dead never forget this beautiful world that gave them being. They will still love its verdant valleys, its murmuring rivers, its magnificent mountains, sequestered vales, and verdant-lined lakes and bays, and never yield in tender fond affection of the lonely-hearted living, and often return from the happy hunting ground to visit
guide, console, and comfort them. Day and night cannot dwell together. The red man has never fled the approach of the white man, as the morning mist flees before the morning sun. However, your proposition seems fair, and I think that my people will accept it and will retire to the conservation you offer them. Then we will dwell apart in peace, for the words of the great white chief seem to be the words of nature speaking to my people out of dense darkness. It matters little where we pass the remnant of our days. They will not be many. The Indians might promise us to be dark. Not a single star of hope hovers about its horizon. Sad-voiced winds mourn in the distance. Grim fate seems to be on the red man's trail, and wherever he will hear the approaching footsteps of his fell destroyer and preparing solidly to meet his doom. As does the wounded doe that hears the approaching footsteps of the hunter. A few more moons, a few more winters, and not one of the descendants of the mighty hosts that once moved over this broad land or lived in happy homes, protected by the Great Spirit, will remain to mourn over the graves of people once more powerful and hopeful than yours. But why should I mourn at the untimely fate of my people? Tribe follows tribe, and nation follows nation, like the waves of the sea. It is the order of nature, and regret is useless. Your time of decay may be distinct, but it will surely come. For even the white man whose God walked and talked with him as friend to friend cannot be exempt from the common destiny. We may be brothers after all, we will see. We will ponder your proposition, and when we decide, we will let you know. But should we accept it, I hear and now make this condition that we will not be denied the privilege without molestation of visiting at any time the tombs of our ancestors, friends and children. Every part of this soil is sacred in the estimation of my people. Every hillside, every valley, every plain and grove has been hallowed by some sad or happy event in days long vanished. Even the rocks, which seems to be dumb and dead as the shelter in the sun along the silent shore, thrill with memories of stirring events connected with the lives of my people, and the very dust upon which you now stand responds more lovingly to their footsteps and yours, because it is rich with the blood of our ancestors, and our bare feet are conscious of the sympathetic touch. Our departed braves, fond mothers, glad, happy-hearted maidens, and even the little children who lived here and rejoiced here for a brief season will love these somber solitudes, and at eventide their great shadowy returning spirits, and when the last red man shall have perished and the memory of my tribe shall have become a myth among the white men, these shores will swarm with the invisible dead of my tribe. And when your children's children think themselves alone in the field, the store, the shop, upon the highway, or in the silence of the pathless woods, they will not be alone. In all the earth, there is no place dedicated to solitude. At night, when the streets of your cities and villages are silent, then you think them deserted. They will throng with the returning hosts that once filled them and still love this beautiful land. The white man will never be alone. Let him be just and deal kindly with my people, for the dead are not powerless. Dead, did I say? There is no death, only a change of worlds. Now, this part is over. Now, moving to next chapter, On Killing a Tree by Jeev Patel. Introduction. Jeev Patel, 1940, is one of the prominent Indian writers in English. He was born in Mumbai, Bombay, and educated at Xavier's High School and Grant Medical College, Mumbai. He is employed as a medical practitioner in Mumbai at present and conducts workshops of poetry for students. Patel belongs to a group of writers who have subscribed themselves to the Green Movement, which is involved in an effort to protect the environment. His poems speak of deep concerns for nature and expose man's cruelty to it. Patel's works include poems 1966, How Do You Withstand? Body 1976 and Mirrored Mirroring 1991. He has also written three plays titled Princess, Savaksa and Mr. Behram. Is a painter too and has conducted several exhibitions of his paintings in India and abroad. His poems have appeared in the New Writing in India, Illustrated Weekly of India, Poetry India and Young Commonwealth Poets. The dominant and persisting concerns in Patel's poetry, according to Arundhati Subramaniam, are the besieged terrain of the human body, its frailty, absurdity and perishability, the vulgar social inequalities of caste and class that continue to assail post-independence India, the predicament of the subaltern, perennially relegated to the sidelines of history and art, the daily catalogue of violence, conflict and pain that make up the century's folk song, the perpetual looming shadow of physical death, and a probing curiosity about what, if anything, lies beyond a world of fraught mortality. On Killing a Tree, included in the collection poems, which was launched by the famous poet Nissim Ezekiel, describes man's cruelty to trees, symbolic of nature, with irony and detachment. The step-by-step process in annihilating the tree is minutely portrayed in the poem. The tree has grown, slowly consuming the earth. It has become strong, absorbing air, water and sunshine. It has rooted itself deep into the soil, hence mere acts of hacking and chopping can't destroy the tree. It has remarkable powers of resilience, so man decides to pull out the root itself and cuts the tree into convenient pieces. His torture of the felled tree continues by scorching and choking it in the sun and air, and by browning and hardening it through various chemical processes. Man is not unaware of the benefits of tree in life, but his greed for wealth has made him utterly callous and insensitive. Though the poem provides step-by-step instructions for destroying the trees, its implied message is against killing trees. The poem underlines the resilience of nature in spite of human violence against it. Patel employs irony and sarcasm to convey his anger against environmental destruction. However, the poem is open for multiple interpretations. It seems to speak of persistence if we want to eradicate a problem. The source of the problem needs to be removed for its total eradication. The language of On Killing a Tree is simple and the diction has remarkable evocative power. The poem is an apt commentary on a major environmental issue, mindless deforestation that human beings face today. Quite characteristic of Patel, the tone of the poem is flat, dispassionate, even offhand, wary of an attempt to ennoble, prettify or sentimentalize the subject matter. The introduction section is over. Coming to the text. It takes much time to kill a tree. Not a simple jab of the knife will do it. It has grown slowly, consuming the earth, rising out of it, feeding upon its crust, absorbing years of sunlight, air, water, and out of its leprous heart, sprouting leaves. So hack and chop, but this alone won't do it. Not so much pain will do it. The bleeding bark will heal, and from close to the ground will rise curled green twigs, miniature boughs, which if unchecked will expand again to former size. No, the root is to be pulled out of the anchoring earth. It is to be robbed, tied and pulled out, snapped out or pulled out entirely, out from the earth cave, and the strength of the tree exposed, the source white and wet, the most sensitive hidden for years inside the earth. Then the matter of scorching and choking in sun and earth, browning, hardening, twisting, withering, and then it is done. Now the text section is over, coming to glossary. Crust, meaning hard outer cover of something, the earth's crust. Next, leprous, meaning resembling leprosy. It is leprous because the surface of the bark is disfigured and irregular. Next, hide, meaning skin. Next, hack, meaning to cut into pieces in a rough and violent way. Next, chop, meaning to cut something into smaller pieces. Next, boughs, meaning large branches of trees. Next, unchecked, meaning unwashed. Next, mean earth cave, meaning the earth bed underground where the root was firmly attached. Next, chalk, meaning to make someone stop breathing by pressing their throat with the hands. Here, it means to deaden the tree by exposing it to overheat. Next, scorching, meaning burning at a high intensity. Next, withering, meaning waning, fading from life. Now, the glossary is over. Moving to exercises. The first section, answer the following questions. First question, in which collection was the poem On Killing a Tree originally published? Option A, Poets. Option B, How Do You Withstand Body? Option C, Mirrored Mirroring. Option D, none of these. Question number 2, what does the word hide mean in leprous hide? Option A, skin. Option B, leaf. Option C, sickness. Option D, none of these. The first section is over. Moving to second section. Answer the following questions in a sentence or two. Question number 1. Comment on the opening line of the poem On Killing a Tree. Second question. Why does the poet say that a simple jab of the knife will not kill a tree? Question 3. Why does the poet try to teach us how to kill a tree? Question 4. What does the poet say of the resiliatory power of trees? Fifth question. What does the poet mean by anchoring earth and earth cave? Question 6. What does the poet mean by the strength of the tree exposed? Question 7. What does the poet mean by the last line, and then it is done? Question 8. What is the tone of grief partial? Question number 8. What is the tone of Jeev Patil's poem On Killing a Tree? Question 9. Comment on the imaginary, the bleeding bark. The second section is over. Moving to third section. Answer the following questions in a paragraph. Question 1. The step-by-step process needed for killing a tree. Question 2. Why it is not an easy job to kill a tree? Question 3. Comment on the language of the poem. Question 4. What is the message of On Killing a Tree? The third section is over. Coming to next section. Question number 1. Answer the following questions in about 300 words. First question, on killing a tree, describes man's cruelty and violence to nature. Discuss. Question 2. How does Jeev Patil employ irony as a poetic device in On Killing a Tree? That section is over. Activity. First question. Compare and contrast On Killing a Tree with William Wordsworth's Daffodils and show how both the poems differ in the treatment of environment. Now, On Killing a Tree is over.
Selate the God, Isaac Bashevis Singer. Introduction. Isaac Bashevis Singer, year 1902 to 1991, is a Polish-born Jewish-American novelist and short story writer in Yiddish. He was born in Warsaw and named Isaac Hers Singer. He took a form of his mother's name Bathsheba, later as his pen name Bashevis. His father was a Hasidic rabbi, and during his adolescence, he was also trained for some time to follow the footsteps of his father, but decided against it, expressing his preference to become a writer like his elder brother Israel Joshua. He married Runia Ponch, but during the turbulent 30s, he migrated to New York City and got separated from his wife and son Israel Zamir when they were forced to move to Russia and then to Palestine. In 1940, he married a German Jewish refugee, Alma Wasserman Niehemann. In 1925, he made his debut as a fiction writer with the short story In Old Age. In the 1930s, he wrote short stories either as Bashevis or Warsawski, though his first novel is Satan in Gore, year 1935. It was a family Moscat published in 1950 that made him famous. Besides his numerous short stories, his major works include novels such as The Slave, year 1962, The Manor, year 1967, and The Estate, year 1969. Singer won Nobel Prize for Literature in 1978 for his impassioned narrative art, which with roots in a Polish Jewish cultural tradition brings universal human condition to life. He died in Florida in 1991. Singer's works often portray traditional Jewish life in Poland and the US and the loneliness of old age. He has dealt with two specific groups of Jews in mythic and realistic terms: the Jews of the old world shtetls, in brackets small villages, and the 20th century emigrants of the pre- and post-Second World War eras. The setting for much of his works was his native Poland. Living in Nazi-dominated Europe, Singer had experienced the horrors of the Holocaust. In novels such as The Family Moscat, The Slave, The Manor, and The Estate, Singer focused on the various aspects of Jewish life in Europe which no longer exist. Enemies, A Love Story, in bracket year 1972, and other writings complement the previous work since they present the protagonists, who are survivors of the Holocaust, seeking to create new lives for themselves. Selate the God, the titular work of Singer's 1966 publication, Selate the God and Other Short Stories, is a poignant story about the bond between human beings and animals. It is set around Hanukkah time in an unnamed Jewish settlement in Poland. Reuven, the Farrier's family, consists of wife Leah, the eldest son Aaron, and two daughters Anna and Miriam. The family falls on bad days as the winter has been slow and relatively mild, and there has been little need for a furrier's service. As a way out, Reuben decides on selling Slate, the god, to Fievel, the butcher, which will fetch him 8 gulden to celebrate the Jewish festival. The job is entrusted to Aaron, who has to obey his father out of necessity. On the way, the weather turns worse. Aaron and Slate are caught in a hailstorm. They lost the way and are trapped in a blizzard. Finally, both find shelter in Haystack, where Aaron finds sustenance from the god's milk. During the 3 days spent inside the haystack, Aaron and Slate develop a special bond where the boy begins to view the god not simply as his pet animal but more like a sister. The unconditional trust of an animal in human beings, seamless nature of the web of life that includes plant and animal kingdom. It was the hay that kept Slate alive for 3 days, which in turn enabled her to feed Aaron with milk. The changing faces of landscape and weather are the major themes of the story. Text: At Hanukkah time, the road from the village to the town is usually covered with snow, but this year the winter had been a mild one. Hanukkah had almost come, yet little snow had fallen. The sun shone most of the time. The peasants had complained that because of the dry weather, there would be a poor harvest of winter grain. New grass sprouted and the peasants sent their cattle out to pasture. For Reuben, the farrier, it was a bad year, and after long hesitation, he decided to sell Slate the goat. She was old and gave little milk. Fievel, the town butcher, had offered 8 gulden for her. Such a sum would buy Hanukkah candles, potatoes, and old for pancakes, gifts for the children, and other holiday necessaries for the house. Reuben told his oldest boy Aaron to take the goat to town. Aaron understood what taking the goat to Fievel meant, but he had to obey his father. Leah, his mother, wiped the tears from her eyes when she heard the news. Aaron's younger sisters, Anna and Miriam, cried loudly. Aaron put on his quilted jacket and a cap with earmuffs, bound a rope around Slate's neck, and took along 2 slices of bread with cheese to eat on the road. Aaron was supposed to deliver the goat by evening, spend the night at the butcher's, and return the next day with money. While the family said goodbye to the goat and Aaron placed the rope around her neck, Slate stood as patiently and good-naturedly as ever. She licked Reuben's hand. She shook her small white beard. Slate trusted human beings. She knew that they always fed her and never did her any harm. When Aaron brought her out on the road to town, she seemed somewhat astonished. She would never been led in that direction before. She looked back at him questioningly, as if to say, "Where are you taking me?" But after a while, she seemed to come to the conclusion that a god shouldn't ask questions. Still, the road was different. They passed new fields, pastures, and huts with thatched roofs. Here and there, a dog barked and came running after them, but Aaron chased it away with his stick. The sun was shining when Aaron left the village. Suddenly, the weather changed. A large black cloud with a bluish center appeared in the east and spread itself rapidly over the sky. A cold wind blew it with it. The crows flew low, croaking. At first, it looked as if it would rain, but instead it began to hail as in summer. It was early in the day, but it became dark as dusk. After a while, the hail turned to snow. In his 12 years, Aaron had seen all kinds of weather, but he had never experienced a snow like this one. It was so dense, it shut out the light of the day. In a short time, their path was completely covered. The wind became as cold as ice. The road to town was narrow and winding. Aaron no longer knew where he was. He could not see through the snow. The cold soon penetrated his quilted jacket. At first, Slaty didn't seem to mind the change in weather. She too was 12 years old and knew what winter meant. But when her legs sank deeper and deeper into the snow, she began to turn her head and look at Aaron in wonderment. Her mild eyes seemed to ask, "Why are we out in such a storm?" Aaron hoped that a peasant would come along with his car, but no one passed by. The snow grew thicker, falling to the ground in large, whirling flakes. Beneath it, Aaron's boots touched the softness of a plowed field. He realized that he was no longer on the road. He had gone astray. He could no longer figure out which was east or west, which way was the village, the town. The wind whistled, howled, whirled the snow in eddies. It looked as if white imps were playing tag on the fields. A white dust rose above the ground. Slaty stopped. She could walk no longer. Stubbornly, she anchored her cleft hooves in the earth and bleated as if pleading to be taken home. Icicles hung from her white beard and her horns were glazed with frost. Aaron did not want to admit the danger, but he knew just the same that if they did not find shelter, they would freeze to death. This was no ordinary storm. It was a mighty blizzard. The snowfall had reached his knees. His hands were numb and he could no longer feel his toes. He choked when he breathed. His nose felt like wood and he rubbed it with snow. Slaty's bleating began to sound like crying. Those humans in whom she had so much confidence had dragged her into a trap. Aaron began to pray to God for himself and for the innocent animal. Suddenly, he made out the shape of a hill. He wondered what it could be. Who had piled snow into such a huge heap? He moved toward it, dragging Slaty after him. When he came near it, he realized that it was a large haystack, which the snow had blanketed. Aaron realized immediately that they were saved. With great effort, he dug his way through the snow. He was a village boy and knew what to do. When he reached the hay, he hollowed out a nest for himself and the goat. No matter how cold it may be outside, in the hay it is always warm. And it was food for Slaty. The moment she smelled it, she became contented and began to eat. Outside, the snow continued to fall. It quickly covered the passageway Aaron had dug. But a boy and an animal need to breathe, and there was hardly any air in their hideout. air on board a kind of a window through the hay and snow and carefully kept the passage clear. Slaty, having eaten her fill, stuck down on her hind legs and seemed to have regained her confidence in man. Aaron ate his two slices of bread and cheese, but after the difficult journey, he was still hungry. He looked at Slaty and noticed that her udders were full. He lay down next to her, placing himself so that when he milked her, he could squirt the milk into his mouth. It was rich and sweet. Slaty was not accustomed to being milked that way, but she did not resist. On the contrary, she seemed eager to reward Aaron for bringing her to shelter, whose very walls, floor and ceiling were made of food. Through the wind, Aaron could catch a glimpse of the chaos outside. The wind carried before it drifts of snow. It was completely dark and he did not know whether night had already come or whether it was the darkness of the storm. Thank God that in the hay it was not cold. The dried hay, grass and field flowers exuded the warmth of the summer sun. Slaty ate frequently. She nibbled from above, below, from the left and the right. Her body gave forth an animal warmth, and Aaron cuddled up to her. He had always loved Slaty, but now she was like a sister. He was alone, cut off from his family, and wanted to talk. He began to talk to Slaty. "Slaty, what do you think about what has happened to us?" he asked. "Ma'am," Slaty answered, "if we hadn't found this stack of hay, we both would be frozen stiff by now," Aaron said. "Ma," was the god's reply, "if the snow keeps on falling like this, we may have to stay here for days," Aaron explained. "Ma," Slaty bleated. "What does ma mean?" Aaron asked. "You would better speak up clearly." Ma, Slaty tried. "Well, let it be, ma." Then Aaron said patiently, "You can't speak, but I know you understand. I need you and you need me. Isn't that right, ma?" Aaron became sleepy. He made a pillow out of some hay, leaned his head on it and dozed off. Slaty too fell asleep. When Aaron opened his eyes, he didn't know whether it was morning or night. The snow had blocked up his window. He tried to clear it, but when he had bored through to the length of his arm, he still hadn't reached the outside. Luckily, he had his stick with him and was able to break through to the open air. It was still dark outside. The snow continued to fall and the wind wailed, first with one voice and then with many. Sometimes it had the sound of devilish laughter. Slaty too awoke, and when Aaron greeted her, she answered, "Ma." Yes, Slaty's language consisted of only one word, but it meant many things. Now she was saying, "We must accept all that God gives us. Heat called hunger, satisfaction, light and darkness." Aaron had awakened hungry. He had eaten up his food, but Slaty had plenty of milk. For 3 days, Aaron and Slaty stayed in the haystack. Aaron had always loved Slaty, but in these 3 days he loved her more and more. She fed him with her warm milk and helped keep him warm. She comforted him with her patience. He told her many stories, and she always cocked her ears and listened. When he patted her, she licked his hand and his face. Then she said, "Meh," and he knew it meant, "I love you too." The snow fell for 3 days, though after the first day it was not as thick and the wind quieted down. Sometimes Aaron felt that there could never have been a summer, that the snow had fallen, always fallen, ever since he could remember. He, Aaron, never had a father or mother or sisters. He was a snow child, born of the snow, and so was Slate. It was so quiet in the hay that his ears rang in the stillness. Aaron and Slate slept all night and a good part of the day. As for Aaron's dreams, they were all about warm weather. He dreamed of green fields, trees covered with blossoms, clear brooks and singing birds. By the third night, the snow had stopped, but Aaron did not dare to find his way home in the darkness. The sky became clear and the moon shone, casting silvery nets on the snow. Aaron dug his way out and looked at the world. It was all white, quiet, dreaming dreams of heavenly splendor. The stars were large and close. The moon swam in the sky as in a sea. On the morning of the fourth day, Aaron heard the ringing of sleigh bells. The haystack was not far from the road. The peasant who drove the sleigh pointed out the way to him, not to the town and Fievel the butcher, but how to the village. Aaron had decided in the haystack that he would never part with Slate. Aaron's family and their neighbors had searched for the boy and the goat, but had found no trace of them during the storm. They feared they were lost. Aaron's mother and sisters cried for him. His father remained silent and gloomy. Suddenly, one of the neighbors came running to their house with the news that Aaron and Slate were coming up the road. There was great joy in the family. Aaron told them how he had found the stack of hay and how Slate had fed him with her milk. Aaron's sister kissed and hugged Slate and gave her a special treat of chopped carrots and potato peels, which Slate gobbled up hungrily. Nobody ever again thought of selling Slate, and now that the cold weather had finally set in, the villagers needed the services of Reuben the farrier once more. When Hanukkah came, Aaron's mother was able to fry pancakes every evening, and Slate got her own portion too. Even though Slate had her own pen, she often came to the kitchen, knocking on the door with her horns to indicate that she was ready to visit, and she was always admitted. In the evening, Aaron, Miriam, and Anna played dreidel. Slate sat near the stove, watching the children and the flickering of the Hanukkah candles. Once in a while, Aaron would ask her, "Slate, do you remember the 3 days we spent together?" And Slate would scratch her neck with a horn, shake her white bearded head, and come out with the single sound which expressed all her thoughts and all her love. Glossary: Hanukkah, Jewish festival of lights, which lasts 8 days in December and celebrates the recapture of the Temple of Jerusalem by Judas Maccabees in 164 BCE, and the miracle of 1 day's oil lasting for 8 days when the eternal light was relit. It is also known as Chanukka. Farrier, one who makes or repairs fur garments. Golden coins formerly used in several European countries. Pancake, a flat cake made of thin batter and cooked on both sides. Flakes, thin flattened pieces or layers. To go astray, to go off the right path or route. Eddy, a current of water or air running contrary to the main current. A small whirlpool. Imp, a small demon fiend. Tag, a game played by two or more children in which one child chases the others and tries to touch one of them. This child then becomes the one who does the chasing. Icicle, a pendant mass of ice formed by freezing of dripping water. Blizzard, a long severe snowstorm. Skirt, to come forth in a sudden rapid stream from a narrow opening spurt. Chaos, total confusion or disorder. Gobbled up, swallowed or ate greedily. Radial, a four-sided toy marked with Hebrew letters and spun like top in a game of chance. The Hebrew letters stand for a great miracle happened there. Exercise question 1. How does Aaron react to his father's decision to sell Slate? Option A. He was proud to be trusted with such an important errand. Option B. He refuses to comply. Option C. He is happy to oblige. D. He is sad but still obeys his father's wishes. Second question. What does Aaron recognize from his stay in the haystack? A. Slate must be sold for the good of the family. B. Slate is a troublesome creature. C. Slate is his friend and cannot be sold. D. All of these. Third question. Aaron gets lost because A. Slate goes wrong way. B. He did not pay attention. C. They were chased by a dog. D. Snow covers the road. Fourth question. Why does the father want to sell Slate? A. He wants to use Slate's skin for fur. B. The family needs money to celebrate Hanukkah. C. The family has many gods. D. She had brought him bad luck. Exercise 2. Answer the following questions in a sentence or two. First question. Why was it a bad year for Reuven the Farrier? Second question. What was the family's response when Reuven asked Aaron to take the god to town? Third question. Why did Slate trust the human beings? Fourth question. Why was Slate astonished when Aaron led her out on the town road? Fifth question. When did Aaron realize that he was no longer traveling on the road? Sixth question. What looked like a snow-clad hill? Seventh question. Why did Aaron realize that the haystack could save them? Eighth question. What did Aaron do for breathing inside the haystack? Ninth question. What does it mean that Slate seemed eager to reward Aaron, and how does it fit with what you have already learned about Slate? 10th question. What do you understand from the way Aaron and Slate communicate with each other? 11th question. How many days did Aaron and Slate spend inside the haystack? 12th question. How did the bond between Aaron and Salati strengthen during their stay inside the haystack? 13th question. What were Aaron's dreams about while he was staying inside the haystack? Exercise 3. Answer the following questions in a paragraph. First question. The circumstances that compelled Reuben to decide on selling Salati. Second question, the communication between Aaron and his God. Third question, compare the character of Salati and Aaron. Fourth question, the days Aaron and his God spent inside the haystack. Fifth question, the change of weather in singers Salati the God. Exercise 4, answer the following questions in about 300 words. First question, critically examine the man animal bond as portrayed in Isaac Bashevis Singer's Salati the God. Second question, how does Singer record the changing moods of weather in Salati the God? Activity 1, find out similar works to Salati the God that discuss the mutual relationship of warmth and togetherness between the man and the animal. Second activity, conduct a discussion on the interconnectedness between man and nature by comparing Salati the God with Ponkunnam Varki's story Talking Bluff.